ready, Sandy.
Okay.
I know.
Which one's Winger's bill?
2977. We're going to gavel.
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order. And in order to accommodate a couple of odd schedules or schedules of odd people or something like that, my colleagues, I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3135 to hear Representative Winger. Then we will close that hearing and hear Representative Cannon. And if there's anybody else testify, we'll reopen it again later. So you're on, I think, right? Is that your bill number?
I respectfully...
Call the wrong number. Yeah. I'm sorry. Close the public hearing on 3135. Open the public hearing on 2977.
Now I heard my bill.
Now you got it. Okay, next we're going to do Jews 2397, right?
3135.
Oh, you're 3135. Okay. 3135 will be next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The absent Mr. Chair and the rest of the committee. I appreciate your willingness to hear House Bill 2977, which does something elegant in its simplicity. It allows people to purchase a health insurance plan from any state in the union. So it essentially opens up interstate commerce in the health insurance field. The idea being that the more people can shop and the more selections are available, the more likely there is to be downward pressure on the price of something. I would ask that the committee think of this not so much as allowing Oregonians to shop for a health insurance plan in another state, as it is allowing Oregonians to shop for a health insurance regulation that they prefer. After all, if I, under this bill, decided to purchase a health insurance plan available in Florida, what I'm essentially doing is purchasing Florida's health care regulation. This is a novel concept, the idea that we would introduce the same kind of competition to regulation that we do to a lot of other things in society, and require people to ask some hard questions about why they're doing what they're doing and whether or not people are making a different choice, why they're making that different choice, and then whether or not we ought to adjust what we're doing so people make our choice rather than that choice. I want you to know that two states have done this, and I have it. Rhode Island signed into law this concept in 2008, and Wyoming just did it this year in 2010. And I will be brief and open up for questions after the following conclusion. Interstate commerce made the U.S. one of the world's most efficient consumer-driven markets, but health insurance is a glaring exception. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Winker. Are there questions?
A question and comment. I apologize for being late. It always amuses me that you can buy pharmaceuticals across state lines and from an outside supplier, and they have to conform to the regulations of the state in which they manufacture, and they have to conform to the regulations in Oregon. Or you can buy nursery stock, and it has to conform to the Department of Agriculture regulations in the state in which it's grown, and the regulations in the state where it's sold. But we can't do that with health care insurance. And it just seems odd to me that we have a lot of other regulated areas that we can regulate in its origin state and in our state, but you can't do it for health insurance. And you're absolutely right. You're buying regulations. I guess I agree with you. That's my question. I agree with you.
Mr. Chair, I take the agreement. I appreciate it. I would add that just as another fact to ponder, the regulations that we have currently in Oregon, which are just like every other state, they're sort of unique and our own creation. No two states have exactly the same. Not, it don't actually apply to everyone in Oregon. So the question of self-insurance comes to mind. If you work for a company that is an employer who is self-insured, then they have not technically purchased insurance from an insurance company. Therefore, the plan doesn't have to cover everything required by Oregon law. Instead, the plan will generally follow federal laws which are administered by the U.S. Department of Labor. So it's not really a uniform system of regulations in the state right now.
Actually, they're not regulated by U.S. law. They're exempted, basically, by ERISA. I have a question, and maybe the next witness after we close and open again is the right one to ask that question. But from your perspective, what's the principle behind state regulation of health insurance or anything else?
Why suppose...
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, I think you have a couple of things in play. One is that this is an area where the federal government is essentially allowing the states to do that, so you're getting different forms of regulation from the states. And I think, obviously, it is some of state regulation is drawn is a product of the drive for safety and control. But I think also what you see is that it just kind of depends on it, to some degree, random pressures that may occur in a certain state. So someone may have a story, they come to the legislature and they want a particular mandate passed, and that mandate then gets passed in that state, but it doesn't necessarily get passed in other states. It may get passed in a few states. So you have a mandate which, to some degree or another, increases cost, obviously, for that insurance plan that just exists in some places, but it doesn't necessarily exist in others. And after a few decades of that going on, you get a scenario where we have now where, as I said, it would no state has precisely the same type of regulation as another state, and it's kind of all over the map as far as the number of mandates that individual, you know, mandates on plans that exist. Oregon has somewhere between 40 and 45. We can't exactly determine the precise number, which is its own interesting anecdote. Of course, it depends on how you define it. And some states have far fewer, and some states have a lot more.
Yeah, I was thinking about this. I sense the notion is that in the basic principles of a free market, there are some basic principles that... One of them is adequate information. And this is a market where I suspect an individual doesn't really have a chance to really figure out what's going on. So, we can buy our Viagra over the Internet. I get 20 ads a day inviting me to do that. And that product is federally regulated, but the insurance product really isn't federally regulated. So maybe somebody has. It's an interesting question. I suspect Mr. Buckstein, Dr. Buckstein, will have a chance to comment on that. His turn.
Mr. Chair, just one response. Just to be clear, we are not talking about a situation in which we would unregulate the market and a person would be able to buy a plan that would be unregulated. What we're allowing them, again, as I said at the beginning, is to buy a plan regulated somewhere else. So even if you chose the smallest populated state in the country, it is still a plan that a state's insurance division or insurance commissioner has, it's gone through that process, and it is allowed and open and available to those Americans located in that state. So we wouldn't be in a scenario where we would be encouraging Oregonians who may not necessarily, as you said, they could not necessarily be fully informed, but they have the protection of knowing that a system in the country has made that plan available, and they are purchasing a plan that is available to, at a minimum, hundreds of thousands of Americans somewhere in the country.
Representative Doherty and then Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I had, I guess, is more, I don't know if you have insurance people that are going to speak with this, but if you have regulations from another state, let's say Rhode Island or Florida or someplace on the East Coast, and they differ quite a bit from the regulations that we have in Oregon, especially when it comes to things like reimbursement and this sort of thing, are the insurance companies or the healthcare providers, are they going to have another layer of bureaucracy, or are they going to have problems with the idea of, well, I'm not going to take your insurance card? Is that your bill doesn't address that, and I was just wondering, what is if I go to I buy a policy out of Florida, and I go to the doctor, and the doctor says I'm not going to take this because I've never had to bill them, and I have to go through this and this and this and this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, I think that, again, don't think of this so much as you're buying a plan from Florida. You are purchasing the regulations from Florida, essentially. So you have insurance companies that can be all over and oftentimes may be in many states, and they may be able to offer a plan with certain benefits in one state, and it has to look different in Oregon. You simply have access to that same amount of coverage that's being offered.
But what if my physician says, I'm not going to accept this because I don't know where I have to send my claim to, you know, wherever.
Representative Doherty, you would have that same issue now, obviously. Certain doctors do not accept certain plans, and so we all end up already in that scenario where we have to make sure that our physician accepts or is part of whatever it is that we're getting insurance for.
Okay, a follow-up question.
Right.
So I'm not necessarily buying a plan, I'm buying a regulation. Is that what it is?
Right.
Well, that's not exactly right.
Well,
it's just a way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
It was just a way of thinking about what you're actually granting Oregonians access to.
I'd buy Pennsylvania's regulations if we could bring them here. Although DCBS might not like that. We'll talk with them in a bit.
You know, he may not be far off on his regulation comment, as I had a meeting with a constituent the other day who was showing me that Trent moved here from Virginia with a Blue Cross plan. They could not transfer from Virginia to Oregon because they're separate companies.
Mm-hmm.
But what they got essentially was a letter of recommendation saying this person was in really good standing, take it to Blue Cross in Oregon and they'll guarantee you insurance. But the same policy costs a lot more in Oregon than it did in Virginia. Because he took the same policy and said, this is what I want. And they wrote it up for him, but it was more money in Oregon. And, you know, it makes you wonder, you know, if the regulations, mandates, all of these things, they got to add up somehow because, I suppose there are actuarial differences too, maybe, but it would be interesting to look at a national plan. What would it be? If
I think President Obama has that in mind.
I was thinking about more than one national plan. One national plan does not get me the competition I'm after.
Representative Kennemer.
Thank you. Some of us are having the experience of serving or sitting on the Senate subcommittee on the exchange issue, Senate Bill 99. And this is kind of intriguing, you know, as we're talking about trying to create a state vehicle that allows you to access, why not broaden the choices, I guess? And I assume that's really fundamentally what this does, is you get to select different benefits and different restrictions based on the regulation and the cost.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kennemer, yes, and obviously with the understanding that you are not unleashing Oregonians to purchase a plan that has suddenly been created whole cloth, or, you know, is coming from some foreign, you know, some unknown entity. Again, there are insurance regulations in every state in this country, and it would not be possible under this bill for an Oregonian to gain access to a plan that isn't already a plan available to hundreds of thousands, perhaps in some cases millions of Americans somewhere else. So it is not the Wild West.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Please. I'm getting confused with this. If can you give me an example of a regulation, first of all, an insurance regulation, and second of all, an insurance regulation that they might have in one state that wouldn't be portable to Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, so there are all sorts of individual insurance mandates that get passed. I was an august member of this body during the last session when we passed 3 or 4 of them, but we already had 37 or so at the time, so we punched over 40 at that point, which puts us kind of in the middle. There are some states that have as many as 70 individual requirements about what must be covered by health insurance, and there are some states that have far fewer. So that as one example, because there are other cost drivers as well, and there are other types of ways that states can regulate insurance that can, and I'm no expert on that, but it can move the cost. But, and Steve Buckstein, I think, is going to talk about this in more detail, one could conceivably purchase a plan from a state that has far fewer mandates on the insurance coverage, which would in turn then very likely mean that you would have a lower rate on your insurance, because if there are fewer mandates on it, then, and they may not be mandates that you're interested in having on your insurance plan.
We're going to have somebody from DCBS. I really
okay. So in other words, it wouldn't cover on chemotherapy in their state, but so the rate might be lower. But you couldn't get chemotherapy here, even though it would cover it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, I think chemotherapy is.
No, I'm just using that. I mean, it would be some sort of.
But it could be something like birth control or Viagra or something that might be particular to one group or another that you would never yourself, under any conceivable scenario, actually need to have insurance coverage for.
And when we open this back up in a few minutes, we're going to invite somebody from DCBS as well as Steve Buckstein to join the session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll send you back down to room 50 with no windows, penalty, and we'll at least temporarily close the public hearing on 2977.
Thank you very much.
And open a public hearing on 3135 and ask Representative Cannon and whoever else he wants to bring to the fore. Are there any other witnesses in this room?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair. Glad to have the honor of testifying this very fine committee today. I bring, for the record, State Representative House Ben Cannon here today with House Bill 3135, and I've brought a constituent, Dr. Don Legrone, who can tell you more about where this idea came from. But before I turn it over to him, in brief, this bill attempts to get at an issue that I think everyone on this committee is very well aware of, and that is the too low reimbursement rate for our Medicaid practicing physicians and Medicaid accepting physicians and dentists. And this bill attempts to provide a small sweetener for folks who are willing to take, despite the really unacceptably low reimbursement rates, are willing to take Medicaid patients in Oregon. It follows an effort, and I think Dr. Legrone will speak to this, but an idea that comes from Mississippi, actually, where Medicaid practicing physicians and dentists are eligible to take part in their state 457 deferred compensation plan. Here, that plan, which is available to public employees, is the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. Members of the legislature, other public employees, are able to put aside some of their pre-tax dollars as retirement, later retirement income. The portfolio is managed by the Oregon Investment Council, does quite well, low fees, other advantages to participating in a 457. So we're hoping, with the passage of this bill, to make Oregon's physicians and dentists who take Medicaid patients eligible for that program. I think there are some technical issues that will need to be worked out with PERS, which administers the plan, with the Oregon Health Authority, which would have to have some, we believe, some reporting mechanism to the PERS. But we are interested, hoping to get the committee interested in this concept, interested enough for us to move forward with those agencies on working through those technical issues if this is in fact something that meets with the committee's interest.
And so we'll have some PERS folks here to answer questions when you're involved.
Great. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Legrone.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
Chairman Greenwich and Thompson, members of the committee, I'm speaking in support of the legislation both as an individual.
Excuse me just a moment.
I'm sorry.
Representative Cannon's got to leave shortly. I wonder if anybody has any questions of him on this before he needs to be somewhere else. And then we'll be back, I hope.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Cannon. I'm sorry. He's welcome to stay as long as he wants, but I was afraid he was going to sneak off.
As I was saying, speaking of the committee, both as an individual and as representative of the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. My name is Don Legrone. I've been practicing pediatrician since I completed my residency training at OHSU in 1979. I currently work at the Children's Community Clinic in Northeast Portland. When I returned to Oregon in 2008, I noted that incomplete participation in OHP by Oregon physicians acts as a significant barrier to children obtaining consistent, high-quality care under the plan. The expansion of coverage provided by last year's Healthy Kids legislation further increases the need for participating physicians and dentists to act as medical homes for these children. Inadequate compensation, particularly in the Portland metropolitan area, continues to be the reason most frequently cited by physicians who avoid accepting larger numbers of OHP clients. For 30 years, I practiced in Mississippi, where low physician compensation also acted as a strong disincentive to provider participation in Medicaid. Mississippi found a simple revenue-neutral mechanism to provide a financial incentive to doctors and dentists to serve more children on Medicaid. The Mississippi Deferred Compensation Plan and Trust, as Ben mentioned, established under Section 457 of the IRS Code, the plan allows providers to defer a portion of the income that they would have received for services provided to Medicaid clients into the Deferred Compensation Program, which grows tax-free until retirement. This does not interfere with any other qualified retirement program and represents an additional financial benefit to providers proportionate to their participation in the Medicaid program. Currently, 841 physicians and numerous dentists participate fully in the program in Mississippi. I personally deferred the maximum annual contribution into the program during my practice, as did many of my coworkers. Over the years, I watched my investment grow proportionate to the number of Medicaid clients I had, and found that it acted as a subtle incentive to acceptance of the program. When I retired from my practice and moved to Oregon, I had a healthy nest egg to bring with me, which was accumulated at no expense to the taxpayers of Mississippi. Given the challenge of low provider participation, I was surprised to find that Oregon had no similar plan available to act as an incentive to providers. While House Bill 3135 will not correct the reimbursement gap most severe in the Portland metropolitan area, which keeps some providers on the sidelines, it will provide a meaningful revenue-neutral incentive to help make the promise of last year's Healthy Kids legislation a reality for the children of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Why don't we call up the PERS folks as well so we can... Joe, are you join us? Who else?
Galen Bass.
Join us as well?
Mr. Chair?
And yes. Barrett had a question.
Couple of questions.
Yeah, first. No, I just wanted to have them around in case the questions
great.
Got into PERS regulations.
And I'm going to excuse myself. Thank you for your tolerance of the scheduling here, Mr. Chair, and I'll
hurry back, please. We
Dr.
have
Legrone on his own here.
Yes, Representative Kenemer.
Are there any limits? As I read the bill, I don't see a limit. Is there no limit on the amount that one could contribute?
Yes, sir, there is.
Where is that?
It's not in the bill. It's governed by the IRS code.
I see. It just can't figure out from the code.
Currently, it's, I think, $16,100 a year. At least that's what it is in Mississippi. I assume it would be the same here, with some adjustment available for older physicians and physicians that are near retirement.
Representative Parrish?
Thank you. So this is for the state deferred compensation, which we can also put into as well. This is not saying this is the OSSER plan or whatever. Is that correct? I'll follow up.
Joe, you want to?
Co-Chair Greenlake, Co-Chair Thompson, and Representative Parrish. For the record, Joe O'Leary, the administrator of the planning policy. I haven't got it committed to memory yet. It's long. Policy Planning and Legislative Analysis Division at Oregon Public Employee Retirement System. Representative Parrish, the answer to your question is that it is not the OPSERP program. This is the bill, House Bill 3135, would amend the state statute that currently excludes independent contractors, and the statute says unless accepted by the legislature, unless otherwise allowed by law, to participate in a 457 plan. 457 is the reference to the Internal Revenue Code, federal law, that allows pre-tax deferred compensation contributions. And Galen Bath, who's seated next to me, is the manager of that program for PERS and can answer specific questions. She's the substantive expert on the deferred comp program in Oregon.
So then that helps me. The follow-up piece then is, if I understand it right, though, when you're contributing 457, 401, you're still capped at the 16,000 and some change. It's not like you can put 16,000 in one and 16,000 in the other. Is that correct?
Yes, Co-Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson. For the record, my name is Galen Bath. I'm the Deferred Comp Manager and Representative Parrish. With the 457 plan, there are no coordinating benefits. So if the doctors had a 401k, they could max out that 401k as well as the 457 plan.
Gotcha. That's
so,
okay.
And it's, yeah.
Representative Hoyle?
As we look at how to solve the problem of access and, I'd say, in rural areas, availability of medical practitioners, we're using lots of different types of practitioners to allow people to have appropriate access. Is there a reason why this covers only physicians and dentists and not, say, nurse practitioners or other primary care practitioners? Or is that just an oversight?
Speaking for myself, I mean no exclusion. Anyone that the legislature wanted to include and that was applicable under the IRS reg would be welcome. It doesn't cost us anything.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
This for the folks from PERS. Is there a sense of how much administrative cost time would be involved if all of the practitioners who suddenly would like to be involved in the state's compensation plan, I'm assuming that's going to take people to make that happen.
Co-Chair Greenlick, Co-Chair Thompson, Representative Parrish, Joe O'Leary for the record again. We don't have a sense of the administrative cost. What I can tell you yet, we haven't done a fiscal on this, and it's going to be, my hunch is it's going to be difficult to quantify. However, and for the record, we are neutral on the bill. We want to make sure that the bill is legal, which is to say that it does in no way jeopardize our federal tax qualification for the plan. And two, we want to make sure it's administrable. And we've identified at least two potential hurdles on the administration side, one having to do with exactly how the money is transferred from A to B, and the other having to do with the reporting requirements that the administrator of the fund is required to report. And we stand ready to work with the Oregon Health Authority to try to navigate exactly how to overcome those barriers. But I think that is going to require some pretty directed conversations with the Oregon Health Authority between us and them, and maybe possibly other stakeholders as well.
Just a quick follow-up question then. Is a government the only person who can administer a 457 account, or is, if I were eligible to put into a 457 account, are there private market places where I could take that money and defer it myself?
Yes, Co-Chair Greenlake and Co-Chair Thompson, Representative Parrish, again, Galen Bath. 457B plans are governmental plans. There are some 457 plans that nonprofits, hospitals can use. Those are different than the 457B, which is what we administer.
Thank you.
Representative Parrish, I put a call in this morning, in fact, to the agency in the state of Mississippi that has run this plan for the last 30 years, and asked them the specific question with regard to expenses of operating the plan and how were those compensated, and they come out of the plan. So they come out of the proceeds or the growth of the investments by the people who contribute to it. So there's, it's still revenue neutral to the state at an administrative level. And for the record.
Okay, well, that's great. I'll follow up with them, too, and try to get some details how they got that done. So thanks.
Could we assume that you are going to have those conversations with the Oregon Health Authority and with Representative Cannon?
Co-Chair Greenlake, Co-Chair Thompson, we've already reached out to the Oregon Health Authority when we heard the bill was put on today. We reached out to them last week, and if it's the desire of the committee, we're happy to be proactive about that. And
well, we're not going to take an official committee position, but I can tell you I'd appreciate it if you did. It sounds like
enough said.
A very interesting way, if it's economically feasible, to reward folks who work with Medicaid.
Yeah, happy to do it.
You might want to include Medicare in that as well, because we're having trouble with getting physicians for Medicare people as well. So, I mean, if we were doing that, we might really want to think about doing that. Primary care for Medicare patients is a big problem.
I should also add, Co-Chair Greenlake, that
we've been dealing with a pediatrician who doesn't know that.
that Ms. Bath has also already reached out to her counterpart in Mississippi, so we're having those conversations on our end too.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else want to testify in this one? We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3135, and thank you for proposing this.
That's
very
interesting.
Okay. Let's do that. Let's reopen 2977 and call Steve Buckstein. And let's ask also Anthony Behrens has offered to be here to answer any questions we may have from the Insurance Division. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, while they're on their way up and getting situated, could we ask Representative Hoyle to introduce the honored guest we have here today, a young scholar, deeply interested in health care. And I'm sure he's going to last through the entire committee meeting, right?
Yes, absolutely.
As long as he has a snack to keep
long of attention span. Yeah. Yes, he's very interested in health care. I would like to introduce both my constituent and my son, Aiden Hoyle. Aiden, why don't you stand up? Who is possibly interested in a career in health services, but in order to do that, he's going to have to really focus on his studies. But right now, he's going to study this committee.
A good mom statement.
Just like a mother. That's right.
Thank you, Buckstein.
Thank you, Co-Chair Greenlake, Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee. I'm Steve Buckstein, Senior Policy Analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute, a public policy think tank based in Portland. I passed out some prepared testimony, and we'll make some remarks about that, and then we'll try to answer a couple of the questions that a couple of you asked earlier to the best of my ability. I'm here today to support House Bill 2977 because I believe that allowing Oregonians to purchase health insurance across state lines is a good thing. I want to focus primarily on something that wasn't touched on in the previous testimony from Representative Wingard, but I know comes up when this issue is raised, and that's what's called the fact that, or the assumption that if we allow Oregonians or anyone in this country to buy across state lines, there'll be a quote-unquote race to the bottom. And I don't believe that that's true with this bill or with this concept. I think it's more likely that we're seeing a race to the bottom with what we're doing now. If we don't enact this bill, I think it's more likely that we're actually seeing a race to the bottom. And to visualize that, just think about as you add mandate after mandate in this building to policies that to the only policies that most Oregonians can buy, those policies get less affordable. Each mandate comes at some cost. If it didn't come at some cost, insurance companies would just put them on because it would be costless to them. Why not? So obviously, any mandate that you add to an insurance policy adds to the cost. As of February this year, according to the state document that I found, there were 42 mandates in Oregon. I've since seen that there might be 45. I'm not sure of the exact number, but I know there are a number of bills before this legislative session to add more mandates. And it's not just conditions or diseases, it's providers, it's covered persons. The total is somewhere, I believe, between 42 and 45 right now. And so I think, again, the real race to the bottom is the race to wipe out everyone's ability in Oregon to afford private insurance. The state can then come to our rescue, providing a single-payer plan, which supposedly will be affordable but won't, in my opinion. We can talk about that later with other bills. But that's, to me, that's the race to the bottom. Let me ask just three questions. Two of them rhetorical, and one I'll answer myself, not asking you to answer them. Not rhetorical, but for you to think about this race to the bottom theory. First one is, since most products are already sold across state lines, as Representative Thompson talked about with certain healthcare products, but virtually everything in this society is already sold across state lines, why isn't there a race to the bottom in every market? Why don't we see the worst quality computers like this one, the worst quality water, the worst quality clothing? Because we can all buy things all across state lines. Why is it somehow different with health insurance? Second, since consumers often buy warranties on products, paying extra for reduced risk, why would they be indifferent to consumer protections and insurance? Why do we assume that if I can buy in the state with the fewest mandates, I'll just blindly do it and not care about whatever the risk is? I just think that goes against human nature for most of us. And the third is, what states are actually near the bottom right now as defined by the opponents of this concept, the states with the fewest mandates? The answer to the third question is Idaho, next to us. It has 13 benefits that must be included in insurance sold within the state, the last data that I had as of 2009. This compares to an average of 42 mandates for all states, and the top state, the one with the most mandates, is Rhode Island with 70 mandates. Another low-mandate state is Iowa with 26 mandates, and like Idaho, it has below-average uninsurance rates, health insurance premiums that are well below the national average. In fact, with 26 mandates, and that's not the only determinant, obviously, of insurance rates, but it has almost half the number of mandates as Oregon, and its annual premiums are, for individuals and families, individual policies, less than half of the states with the highest premiums, which are Massachusetts and New York. So there's a wide variation in mandates and correspondingly a wide variation in premiums. And my point is that I think Oregonians should have the right to make those choices. They're adults. They can do the analysis for themselves. In answer to Chair Greenlick's question about adequate information, I agree. There may not be adequate information in many cases, but it's there. If you look at, as Co-Chair Thompson pointed out, the wrestling with how to set up an exchange in Oregon, there are exchanges already there. I went on, after hearing the Senate committee on how to set up this exchange, and heard the eHealth.com people talking. They want the business, obviously, and hopefully you're going to require competition. There's going to be other people in there. You're not going to do it like you do healthcare here and eliminate the competition. But I went on their site, and the first couple questions they ask are, I think it's your gender, your age, and your zip code, because they want to know what state you're in. And then they only show you the policies that you, the legislature, allow Oregonians to buy. But I put in other zip codes. I fudged. And you can look at any zip code, any state in the country, and you can see policies that other people, that other states, allow their citizens to buy. It's very interesting. The adequate information is there. Once you allow Oregonians to make that choice across state lines, I think it might take a little bit of time, but there'll be easy ways to compare the risks and rewards of buying those policies from other states. In answer to Representative Doherty's question about what mandates does Oregon have that others don't, or vice versa, I forgot to actually bring the copy of the latest document that I have, 2009, but I just brought it up online. And just for example, and I can get you this, the link to this document for all 50 states and D.C. Oregon covers, and again, these Oregon covers autism along with 23 other states. Only three states, including Oregon, cover bilateral
cochlear. Gherkin doesn't cover autism.
Doesn't it?
No, they're,
okay.
They're driving us crazy.
Maybe I'm looking at the wrong line here. The range goes, and there's probably less. I can't look at the whole document here.
Actually, Chair Greenlight, I think we have a bare minimum that we cover of autism. Wasn't it like 6 appointments a year for speech therapy? We do cover some autism.
What the bill we passed about autism was that you couldn't reject the delivery of services for the autism diagnosis that would be available for other diagnoses, just to make autism the same as any other thing under the parity. But the specific treatment stuff under, you're actually right. I mean, that's true. We do sort of have a law on autism, but it isn't really a mandate.
This is a summary, obviously, when they say autism. Yeah. I'm sure there's a wide range of what different states cover, and you need a lot more, as you said, a lot more adequate information. But 51 states cover breast reconstruction, including Oregon. Only 3, according to this, cover bilateral cochlear implants. And again, I'm sure there are variations. But you look down the whole list of all of the mandates that all the states cover, and there's a wide range. And Oregon is in league with many other, with some states that cover all of them, some states that cover almost none that Oregon covers. So that's the point, is that Oregonians should have more choices than they're allowed now and make their decisions. And that's what I would, that's why I would support this bill. Thank you.
Questions? Steve, did you? Yes, go ahead.
And you may not know this, Steve. I don't know the number myself, but I know we have people working in Oregon that have insurance from other states. Do you have any idea what that number is, by chance?
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, no, I don't know the number. I think as Representative Wingard mentioned, the mandates that are applied to Oregonians only cover some Oregonians. If you're with a big company, I think is what you're getting at, you're with an Intel maybe, you can buy insurance from another state because they're self-insuring. If they are, I don't know if they are.
You can also buy a national policy for some of those companies.
Right.
That's probably what you're talking
about. So there are obviously some Oregonians who have insurance covered from out of state. Another point, though, which I think Representative Doherty was getting at, was what if my doctor doesn't take the insurance that I choose from Idaho, let's say. That's already the case now. As Representative Wingard said, you might pick a policy that Oregon allows that your doctor doesn't allow. But this bill, I assume, I haven't analyzed all the legalese, but I assume would not require any insurance company in or out of Oregon from selling to Oregonians. There may be, very well be, insurance companies in Idaho or Florida or wherever who say it's not a good fit for us to sell in Oregon for whatever reason. Either the risk pool is not to our liking, or it's too far away, or whatever. So this doesn't impose a mandate on any insurance company that says, if I'm an Oregonian, I can buy anywhere. It says it gives me the right to buy it if they'll sell it to me.
I'd like to ask a question. You're an analyst. Your basic underlying assumption is the price is inversely proportional to the number of mandates. And I think you could make an argument, I'd be interested in seeing an analysis, that the price of premiums is directly related to the average cost of health care in an area. I mean, if you take Medicare costs, you mentioned the 2 most expensive states in the country, California and New York. My prediction is premiums would be higher in those because the medical patterns are much higher. Idaho, I suspect, is among the lowest Medicare average cost states because the practice is lower, and I would suspect the costs in Oregon are based on medical practices in Oregon and fees and things like that, but that would be an interesting analysis.
Chair Greenlick, I agree with you. I never thought that the policy, the premiums were directly or inversely proportional to just the number of mandates. Everything else being equal, that would probably be true, but everything else isn't equal.
But it might be a very small.
Well,
it'd be interesting to test that.
Again, according to the analysis that I've seen, mandates increase premiums, everything else being equal, between 1 and 3%. Okay. Obviously, there are outliers, but
that's what I would
between think. 1 and 3%. So if a state like Idaho has 13 mandates and a state like Rhode Island has 70, you're looking at something like 50, you could see a 57% difference in the premiums, everything else being equal.
Well, you're talking about 1 to 3% for each mandate.
Yes, for each mandate.
I like to see some analysis on that. Representative Daugherty?
I'm trying to understand this. So, for example, let's say I figure as an adult I will never need mental health care. And so I find a policy in another state that does not mandate mental health care. And I get that policy. And so it's not going to cover any mental health. Now, what happens from a practical standpoint if I do all of a sudden have a mental health issue that I and I live in Oregon, yet this doesn't cover it? Does this mean that I would not have coverage? Number one, and I guess the follow-up is, if I didn't have coverage, then I would have to pay for it myself. Is that how it works?
Co-chairs and Representative Daugherty, yes, basically that's how it works. But I'm not sure if mental health, it's one example. But
I'm just using an example.
Sure. But I think a different example that might be more instructive is PSA tests for men, PAP tests for women, something that I think most doctors recommend clearly that you have after a certain age. But that doesn't mean that you should insure for them. You should budget for them. If there's something that you know as a woman or I know as a man I'm going to do every year or every other year, it doesn't make any sense to pay a third party, the insurance company, to insure me, and yet the state of Oregon mandates those, I believe, in the insurance policy. It would be cheaper if people just realize that those are things that are going to be costly, that they're going to have to pay for with healthcare dollars, but they're not subject to insurance, because insurance as a concept is to cover things that are rare, expensive, and we don't know who's going to get it. Cancer, for example. Not everybody gets cancer, but those who do, it's very expensive. Most of us can't afford it ourselves. We don't know who's going to get it, so that's a perfect candidate for insurance. Mental health, maybe also. PAP tests, PSAs, or not, to me. And so I think a lot of the choices that people make, people just assume that, oh, well, gee, I need a PSA test every year, so I'm glad the state of Oregon forces me to pay for that in my insurance. I think it just raises the cost. I think it would be cheaper for me to do it myself.
Okay, follow up. Mm-hmm. So this is a little bit kind of like a catastrophic insurance policy, which is much cheaper if you go out and buy on your line. A catastrophic policy versus one that would
if that's cover what you prefer, yes. I think you should be allowed to do that. Now, again, a lot of people don't prefer that. They don't want to take the risk. They want to insure for as much as they can, and that should be their choice.
Mm-hmm.
But if someone else's choice is catastrophic, getting hit by a bus and cancer, the really expensive things, you see lots of young people who probably can afford, quote-unquote, health insurance, who choose not to buy it because they're willing to take the risk. They may very well buy it if it was simply catastrophic and they could get it for a very low premium.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hoyle?
Coming from an area with a local Oregon-based insurance company and one of the higher unemployment rates, certainly in my county, I'm just wondering, wouldn't this disadvantage Oregon-based companies and encourage investment and jobs out of state? Because if you have states that have place different values on certain things, for instance, who don't have mental health parity or contraceptive equity or, you know, cover mammograms or PSAs or whatnot, and there is a lower initial cost, would that not then disadvantage Oregon companies and put Oregonians out of work? I'd be rather concerned about that.
Co-chairs and Representative Hoyle, I don't think so, because as I understand it, again, as the earlier discussion, many companies self-insure. There are ways to buy policies nationally. And Intel, for example, I think could already do what you're saying, but they don't. There is a competitive reason, probably, why companies purchase insurance. We're mainly talking about individuals and families who are not covered through their employer and who don't have those choices. Isn't that correct, Representative Johnson?
It is, yeah.
Please. So, for instance, in Lane County, where I come from, 94% of the businesses are 50 people or under. So 94% of the businesses are not Intel or not, you know, a Nike or not a University of Oregon. So these are the companies that, again, are struggling to find lower insurance costs, but also are not doing, you know, they don't have the kind of leverage that an Intel has. So, again, I think you're talking about an exception rather than a rule. And again, what I see this as, and I understand where you're getting to, and I appreciate that a creative approach. We have to do things differently. So I appreciate everything that's on the table. But what I don't want to do is give an incentive for a company to take their headquarters and move them out of state. What I don't want to do is give an incentive for what we have is a very good community partner, you know, Pacific Source Health Insurance Plans. They're in Springfield. They're an excellent community partner. They have excellent customer service. They do a great job. But at the end of the day, I don't want to put those people out of work. So I guess that would be one of my big concerns.
Co-Chair Thompson, Representative Hoyle, I'm not sure why this would put either the people that work for the 94% of their small businesses or Pacific Source out of work. If Oregonians could buy from out of state, that doesn't say that people would stop buying from Pacific Source. But if they did, what you're talking about is protectionism. What you're talking about is trying to protect Oregon businesses at the expense of your constituents. And I don't think that's ever a good idea. It sounds like a good idea in many cases, but what it leads to is, again, protectionism, and basically you might benefit one company, Pacific Source, for example, at the expense of many of your constituents who can't afford to buy from Pacific Source.
Can I do one last follow-up?
Absolutely.
I think this is probably a more philosophical difference. We could be talking about free trade versus fair trade and, you know, where do you give an unfair advantage? But I think we have made decisions, and whether we have this, I wasn't in the legislature when those decisions were made, whether we agree or don't. We made decisions on certain values that we have as Oregonians. I live in Oregon because I appreciate the values that we govern this state by. And again, I don't think it's protectionism to say we live in this state, we have these laws, we have these standards. I would say standards as opposed to mandates. We have these standards, and other states don't have those standards, and people are welcome to go to those other states. But in our state, if we're going to have certain standards about what's covered, if we're going to have certain standards about how consumers are protected, I mean, I would be concerned about, with an Oregon company, if there is a consumer protection issue, we can go right to that Oregon company. If we're in another state, that's a whole different level of ability to protect our consumers, protect our small businesses. So again, I do appreciate you bringing this forward, but again, we probably have some fundamental philosophical differences.
Just one response. I agree. We might have some philosophical differences. I think that freedom of choice is an important value that is being, I don't want to use the word stifled, I guess, but sort of tamped down by too much regulation, and I think if Oregonians saw the choices they could have, they might direct you to make different choices for them. Maybe lack of information, as Chair Greenlich talked about, is part of the reason that we've gotten to where we are, that now with technology, that doesn't have to be that way anymore. Oregonians can see a plethora of choices. Whether they're allowed to choose them or not is something they have to decide with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, would it be safe to say that the principle of this bill is offering an opportunity for the small businesses that employ 3 to 5 people or 40 people that can't afford to buy health insurance, that they could go buy a mandate-free health insurance policy to give their employees some basic coverage that have no coverage at that point? Because rather than paying $1,000, they could get it for $700 or $500?
Co-chairs and Representative Widener, that's one way to look at it. It would make it easier for small businesses who can't afford Oregon-mandated policies now to probably purchase one somewhere else. That brings up a whole other issue. I've testified before this committee in past sessions. I don't think that it's the best public policy to purchase insurance through your employer in the first place. It's an anachronism of World War II wage and price controls. Senator Wyden and others have talked about changing that. It's very hard to change, obviously, but I don't see this bill as benefiting the small companies as much as benefiting the individuals who work for them. You have people who work for those small companies who are getting a total compensation package from that company, what the company thinks they're worth, whatever that is. And the company's making the decision as to how much comes in salary, how much comes in health care, how much comes in retirement, whatever the package is. Again, I think that should be up to the individual. And young people may make a very different choice about the portion that goes to health care as older people. So I see this, again, as benefiting your constituents, and it should be neutral to the employers. I know it's not right now, but that's where I think we should be heading.
Is it Parrish?
Thanks. Mine's kind of a little bit of a two-parter. I kind of am wanting people to shop around and get good deals. That's what I do for a living. So, but two things. So, as I understand this, if we were to pass a bill like this in Oregon, and now I'm going to my kid's doctor, and I have a plan from, I don't know, some other state that says we don't cover one of the 42 things here in Oregon. I mean, essentially that would be like when I go and get pre-authorization or whatever now for something through TRICARE, that would be like, well, hey, you know, Julie, your insurance doesn't cover that. And that would essentially be the conversation if I bought in, say, you know, Arkansas and then used that insurance here if it was something that Mike's policy didn't cover because it was housed there. Would that work that way, or they're not required then to cover one of our 42 mandates? That's the first part of it. Second part of it then is, you know, we're hearing some conversation around saving a business money, which I'm, you know, I'm totally appreciative of. The flip side of that, though, is if I'm one of the folks, we've heard several bills around mandates, you know, autism and cleft palate, and we're having that conversation. Feasibly, though, I could also go buy from a state that has a mandate for something if I wanted to pay whatever those fees are and then have coverage in Oregon. Is that how it works? I mean, is that understanding this bill the right way?
Co-chairs, Representative Parrish, to answer your second question first, I believe so. If the state of Oregon didn't have cleft palate coverage and you thought that was important, there are states that do, I assume, and you could find one of those policies and purchase it. Well, right now, apparently you can't until the legislature lets you. Your first question about, again, getting back to you buy a policy in Arkansas and your child has some disease, or you go into your doctor and suddenly find out that he doesn't take your insurance. That doesn't have to happen because, again, on eHealth, as I look through it, most providers already will tell you what insurances they take and don't take. In this case, in Oregon, I think Providence is one that didn't, which surprised me because that's what I have, and you have to go to them and ask. But if you had competition, you would be able to go to the exchange or whatever system is set up and say, okay, this is the policy I'm interested in. Does my provider or my network take it? And you can find out online before you ever purchase the policy.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
So, but if, I guess what I'm asking, though, is, if Blue Cross Oregon has 42 mandates and Blue Cross Arkansas, I'm assuming they're there, I'm just making things up now, but Blue Cross Arkansas or whatever doesn't have to respond to those mandates, and I buy there and I have Blue Cross and my doctor takes Blue Cross, and that's where I'm going. Then one of those 42 mandates that I'm not paying for there, are they still covered here?
No, you would be able to find out before you purchase the Arkansas.
The answer would be no.
Whether your doctor or your system took the Arkansas Blue Cross.
Okay, gotcha.
Now, they don't have to tell you, I guess, but why would you buy a policy, why would you use a healthcare provider who didn't tell you if your insurance was covered till after the fact? I mean, the market pressure, I think, would make them tell you, and many of them already tell you online. Some don't, apparently. But right now, you can go online to eHealth and see, pick a policy in Oregon and see if your doctor takes it.
Thanks.
This is a beautiful fantasy, but the reality is the individual market is very different than the insurance market. And my guess is if we all went in to eHealth to try and buy an individual coverage policy in Idaho or in Arkansas where they asked
For example, what's your weight? Have you ever been diagnosed with dermatitis? Are you taller than 6 foot? I mean, any of these things go into that. My guess is that virtually none of us would be able to get an individual policy going in the market that way. But the one thing that group health does is it allows the sharing of that. So I certainly wouldn't be able to get it, having been diagnosed with cancer. If you had an autistic kid and they asked about the diagnosis of all the people you want to be covered, you wouldn't get an insurance policy on the individual market that covered autism. It just would not happen in terms of the way things are rated. Now, under the new national regulations, where individual plans won't be able to risk rate you that way, things might change, but then we're creating a whole different environment.
Chair Greenlick, if that's the case, then why not just pass this bill, because it won't change anything? You never know until people have the opportunity. We all might get turned down by everybody outside of Oregon, but let's find out. Why not allow people the choice?
And when we get turned down in Oregon, we have a high risk pool to deal with it. I think we need to go on. Do you have any comments on this, on what it looks like from DCBS's perspective?
Chair Greenlick, Chair Thompson, for the record, my name is Anthony Behrens. I'm a senior policy analyst with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the Insurance Division. And I was asked to come here today to answer any questions that you have, and to the extent I can, I will. As far as comments go with the particular bill, I guess we've just identified some issues that the legislature may want to consider when looking at the legislation. And when we looked at the bill, it's not clear to us how exactly that these foreign regulations would be enforced here in Oregon. What the bill does is it essentially exempts an insurer that's licensed. It doesn't appear to me that it exempts a product. Rather, it exempts an insurer that is licensed in another state. And the exemption would at this point appears to extend to products such as personal injury protection. So an insurer that would sell personal injury protection insurance as part of an automobile policy would actually possibly be exempt from the insurance code here in Oregon. I'm not sure that that's what's intended here, but we do see that as one of the issues. In addition, if you had, say, a company out of Florida issue a policy to an Oregon resident, it's not clear to us if there was some dispute between the consumer and the company. Would Florida then come in? I'm not sure how that consumer would be helped, because what the bill does is it exempts the insurer from Oregon regulation. So the insurance division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services would not have any kind of authority over that company.
Could they, if they're licensed in Florida, they're exempt here, could they then come into Oregon and do business big time in Oregon without the Oregon regulation?
Well, that's my understanding, that they would not be subject to any regulation under the insurance code, which goes far beyond just the mandates. It also includes the assessments. I think the OMIP assessment is actually part of the insurance code. Healthy Kids assessment is part of the insurance code. Obviously, our assessment is part of the insurance code. So they wouldn't be paying any assessments. You brought up, Chair Greenlick, in 2014, things are going to be a little bit different, and there are going to be minimum standards for insurance policies. So it is possible that at that point federal regulation would kick in if this bill passed, and obviously these insurers would have to offer a minimum type of policy that met those standards. Also, in Oregon, we have what's called the guarantee fund, where insurers contribute to a fund that if one of them goes out of business, the fund will kick in and then help pay policyholders that have lost their insurer. So it makes sure that their claims get paid. There would not be any payment by these foreign insurers into that fund. And those are kind of the things that jumped out to us that we thought maybe you guys might want to look at a little bit more.
So I hear you saying this doesn't allow me to buy a product in Florida, you know, like buying my Viagra in Florida and sending it here. This allows those companies to do business in Oregon, and therefore allows. So I might try and buy a plan under this, and they would say, no, we don't do business in Oregon. This might not change that, right?
Chair Greenlink, Chair Thompson, if I understand your question, what it does is it exempts insurers from following the requirements of the insurance code in Oregon. So it's my understanding under this bill, a Florida insurer could come in and offer coverage in Oregon. They just would not have to follow any of the insurance code, pay any of the assessments in the insurance code. And it's not clear to me that they would have to follow the Florida insurance code with that particular policy. I don't know. That the bill doesn't talk to that. So I hope that answered your question.
It does. Representative Thompson.
Backing up a little bit, can you give us some idea how we got where we are? Why is insurance so tightly regulated state by state when so many other industries, businesses are not? There must have been a reason, or somebody thought they had a reason to get where we are right now.
I can give you, Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlink, I can give you kind of my basic understanding, and then I can hopefully supplement that later. But my understanding is that state-based insurance regulation goes back, I think, almost 100 years. So it's okay. Traditionally been a state-regulated market. And as each state has developed their own regulations, they just simply, incorporated the local culture and values of the state.
It seems strange to me that, I'm so regulated on what I can buy for health insurance, but, I can buy Colonial Penn life insurance off the off television, and, of course, I don't even know if I got a good deal on that or not until it's too late. But at least with health insurance, I know next week that they might not pay the bill, and I can get something else, but so many of the other products aren't regulated or don't seem to be regulated as heavily. And
is that true? Can life insurance companies that aren't regulated in Oregon sell insurance to Oregonians?
Well, Representative Greenlink, Chair Greenlink, Chair Thompson, I'm not an expert in life insurance, but it's my understanding that all the products sold in Oregon, the policies have to be filed and meet Oregon standards, and the companies also have to be licensed here.
Well, thank you both very much. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2977 and open up a work session on House Bill 2397. And Madam Administrator, where are we in this one?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
That's a roadmap. We have Representative Cannon back now. We can really go to work.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, you'll recall 2397 was part of the bills that we heard presented by the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. This was the third one of the two previous bills that we've moved on to Ways and Means. The specific bill creates the loan forgiveness program for the primary care practitioners in the Office of Rural Health. It appropriates money to the office for the purposes of the program, and it creates the Primary Health Care Loan Forgiveness Program Fund. It declares an emergency effective on passage. The proponents of the bill had requested a -1 amendment. That is before you. That amendment requires that participants that are enrolled in the Rural the participants be enrolled in the Rural Scholars Program at Oregon Health and Sciences University. It also authorizes OHSU to collect on default loan. It adds a requirement that if a participant student fails to complete the required course of study, they are required to repay the amount received back to the primary health care loan forgiveness program plus 10% interest. In addition, we had a last-minute Dash 2 amendment, which, like 2400, is allocating the money through DAS to the Office of Rural Health. That was a technical fix into this bill also. Mr. Chair, we do have fiscals and revenues on the Dash 1 and 2s. Should the committee choose to move the bill forward, the committee should look at both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2s before they move the bill forward. And we have, like I said, this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
And is everybody okay with the Dash 1s and 2s? Have you heard any?
The proponents of the bills have requested both of them. I have not heard back that there was a problem with either one. So
okay.
The good representative of the Oregon Academy for Family Physicians is in the audience. Should you choose to invite him up?
Is there hair on fire, or are they sitting calmly?
He's calm.
If we're sitting calmly, I'd say. Okay, can we have a motion on the Dash 1s?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
If we eliminated DAS, we could probably afford all of these programs.
That comes right after the Senate. After we eliminate the Senate, DAS is our next target.
DAS is the next target? I think DAS's budget's bigger than the Senate's.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2397, dated 3-4-11.
Is there any discussion on the motion? Representative Thompson moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2397.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Is that going to... I haven't got a chance to go through them, but is that going to change the fiscal or anything on these whatsoever?
No, it just changes the clarification of who's eligible for the program. The fiscal is going to be high enough anyway.
Yeah, well,
right. The
fiscal will change itself. Yeah,
right. Well, I just was wondering if there was a motive behind the Dash 1 or Dash 2 amendments just to see if it would get rid of the fiscal or reduce it or anything like that. So.
It doesn't get rid of it. It strengthens the rural scholars program, which is something that it's a good thing, takes kids from rural areas and puts them in the medical
school. Very supportive of the program.
Any objection to the amendment? So moved. How about the Dash 2s?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2397, dated 3-7-11.
Representative Thompson moves to put the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2397. Any discussion? Any objections? So moved.
Ready?
The bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2397 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Is there any discussion on the motion? Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2397 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Mr. Chair,
yes, sir.
My sentiments are the same as before. I know we're sending these to Ways and Means to die, and I think it's not responsible for us to do that, and for there I will be a no.
We've drafted, you might be interested, we're in the midst of drafting a memo you might find interesting where we're talking about recognizing the situation and hoping that they'll give these things due consideration. Because, I mean, at least that we're specifying, these are very high priority needs, but they still may die.
It's a rough situation because, I mean, like I was saying, sometimes we make cuts in places where we shouldn't be making cuts. I mean, nobody, when we stand on the floor, we never mention DEQ, we never mention DAS. I mean, you go outside this building, people would love for us to make cuts in departments like that. People would love it if they didn't have to go to the DEQ stations and could do it at Oil Can Henry's. But that's not where we're making the cuts, and this is something that will end up on the chopping block as well. So, unfortunately, and it's sad that we're in that situation.
I would like to say that some of my constituents would like to see DEQ increase and try and do something about the content of the air around their schools. Mr. Cannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I do hope that these are able to get, at least see, you know, a glimmer of daylight down in Ways and Means. And I, for that reason, am hopeful that we don't overburden Ways and Means with a bill that needs a lot of additional work. So I wonder whether the financial aspects of this have been clearly worked out on our part here. I noticed that it has, I believe, a $525,000 appropriation. If I'm looking at the right fiscal impact statement, there may have been one issued subsequently. That only shows up in the 11-13 biennium. I was curious why it then zeroes out in the 13-15 biennium. And I'm just trying to make sure that we understand the fiscal mechanism here for loan forgiveness. Presumably, that $525,000 is not paid out. That's not forgiving loans in the 11-13 biennium. My assumption was that the students would be identified in the first years of the program.
We've had some discussion about that, and I think I can comment. The current policy is when they put a student into the program, and they accept a student in the second year, they accrue all the money for that student, and so that you accrue a whole bunch of them, and they have to come back. I've since found out that they don't have to do it that way. And that's something that can be taken up in Ways and Means. In fact, they can guarantee a loan repayment without putting the money in this time, with the understanding that it could conceivably get unguaranteed, but it's the same way the state issues a bond. They're offering to repay it. I mean, they're promising to repay it over time. So this is something that could be worked out in Ways and Means, but it is the current policy. So if they identify five students, they'll put all the money into the... they'll accrue all the money for those five students through their whole repayment process.
Do you...
I think I have that right, right?
Do you understand why the fiscal shows $0 going into this program in 13-15? I would have thought, if anything, the two would be reversed, that we might be projecting some future expenses that we're unable to pay for now. In fact, and I think the note here indicates that the measure does not specify if the intent of the $525,000 general fund appropriation is one-time or ongoing. I don't know whether this committee wishes to express its intent about that appropriation. Again, recognizing how hypothetical a world we're... how hypothetical this question is.
I would hope this gets interest, and this is in the range that could conceivably get funded. It gets interest in either way it can. And it just gives them the most flexibility.
Yeah. My comment on that, Mr. Chair, would be that if this program is good and valuable, as I think it is, then this ought to be an ongoing appropriation. And $525,000 in one biennium is terrific. That'll get a few students started, and we should carry forward into the subsequent.
I'm guessing, I mean, I believe there's nothing in this bill that doesn't allow it to be forward funded. This doesn't have a sunset, does it?
No.
So it can be, the authorization is there. The question is, is it going to get funded in the future years? Okay?
Yeah.
Not okay?
I'm fine with it.
Okay.
Did you have a motion on the table?
Yep. We have a motion on the table. Can we call the roll, please?
Representative Doherty?
Yes.
Representative Parrish?
Yes.
Representative Boyle?
Yes.
Representative Weiger?
No.
Co-Vice Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Kennemer?
Aye.
Co-Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Green?
Aye. Motion passes. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2397. Open up a work session on House Bill 2111.
Okay, I need to
guide us to this one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2111 had a public hearing on February 2nd. This bill clarifies provisions that relate to isolation and quarantine of persons with communicable diseases and isolation of property contaminated with toxic substances, modifies the references to the Oregon Health Authority to reflect that the public health director or the local public health administrator be cited. At the time, we had testimony on the issue around confidentiality and some other issues that were raised by the ACLU. Both the Assistant Attorney General of the department and ACLU worked on it. We have the dash twos ahead before us. If you have any questions, Shannon O'Fallon, we can get her on the phone if you want to be walked through the amendments. They're okay. Andrea could not be here this afternoon. I do have an email that clarifies that ACLU is good with the dash two amendments. Should the committee, well, her recommendation is that they support the bill as long as the dash two amendments are incorporated into the bill. We do have a fiscal, minimal fiscal impact, which is just basically a standard classification that if the agency incurs a net fiscal impact greater than the minimal, it will have a cumulative effect on the agency, and there's a no revenue impact on the bill, Mr. Chair. And there's no subsequent referral.
And you have a sense of what the dash twos do? It's in the hand and gross version, huh?
Right, and if I understand correctly, it specifies and clarifies that the public health director or the local public health administrator are not required to give prior notice to a person who is the subject of a position, but shall make reasonable efforts to serve the person or the group of persons subject to the isolation or quarantine with the petition before the petition is filed. Prior notice is not required in an ex parte proceeding, and it clarifies that the 72-hour, and I believe the 72 hours relates to the notification, is extended for a person detained under either an administrative or ex parte emergency order. If you want a more detailed explanation, I will call Shannon, and we can get her on the phone. She is sitting at her desk.
Well, let's have a discussion before we have a motion. Are there questions? Should we get her?
I'm good with it.
I'm okay.
Okay. Then let's have a motion on the dash twos. The real issue, I think, is on the very last page of the hand engrossed version, and it's a deletion of things under Section 9 that I know ACLU was worried about. It was that question about whether these are open or closed. And I think it deals with that. Representative Thompson.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash 2 amendments dated to House Bill 2111, dated 2-14-11.
Representative Thompson moves that we adopt the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2111. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. Motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2111 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2111 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Parrish?
Aye.
Representative Boyle?
Yes.
Representative Whitehair?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Cannon?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion passes.
I hope we didn't take the part in there where the public health officer can carry a gun out.
He does already.
I think that is so cool. Already. You know that.
Is this okay. Bill? Is this somebody's bill?
This was at the request of the health authority.
Okay. So we need a carrier. Do I have a volunteer?
Or do you want to put?
No, I think we need to bring this to the floor.
So I'll carry it if nobody else will.
You got it,
Mr. Kinnamer. Did you want to?
I'll defer to you. I was going to.
He was being a good citizen.
I was a good citizen. You were better.
Did we tell you we assigned you to carry a bill last time when you were absent?
Oh, good.
Okay.
He didn't tell him.
No, didn't tell me.
That was your price.
Well, there were always surprises.
Sure, it was from.
Okay, I close the work session on House Bill 2111 and open a work session on House Bill 2099, which has a subsequent referral to revenue. Administrator.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you at the request of the Oregon Health Authority. We had a public hearing on the 18th of February. This requires the Department of Revenue to provide a place on the personal income tax return form for information about the taxpayer's uninsured child and referral for health insurance coverage. It requires that the Department of Revenue, the Oregon Health Authority, and the Department of Human Services to enter into a data sharing agreement for the purposes of relating to the requirements under the Federal Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. This has an emergency clause effective on passage. We do have a Dash 1 amendment that was submitted by the Department of Revenue. It does some minor changes. We changed the word income to return on page 2. We deleted a Section 2 reference on page 4. Removed DHS and the Oregon Health Authority from a couple of subsections on page 4 and referenced it back to Section 2 of the bill. Section 2 of the bill is what outlines, already specifies the relationship between the Department of Revenue, the Health Authority, and DHS. And we changed the effective date for the tax years. The original bill specified 2011. The amendment changes it to next year, 2012. Mr. Chair, this does have a subsequent referral to revenue. However, the committee has been, I've talked to the co-speaker's office. The revenue can be rescinded off of this, but it will have to go to Ways and Means because there is a fiscal impact.
So it's going to switch from revenue to Ways and Means, and that needs to be in the motion?
Correct. So the motion would reflect that you rescind the Department of Revenue or the subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee, that is rescinded, but you're adding on a referral to Ways and Means. And I believe you have a copy of the fiscal impact on...
I don't.
What
does it say?
There's some people in the back who are suggesting otherwise.
Here's that. Are suggesting what?
Nope.
Sorry. Here's this.
Okay, so we don't know whether there's a fiscal.
There's a one-time $10,000, and they're saying it's got to go to Ways and Means.
Thanks.
We've been told anything with $1 goes to Ways and Means.
Could we ask someone to approach the front and
give us
some information on why their head is nodding so vociferously? While they're doing this, Mr. Chair, in my reading of this, this is requiring the tax forms to have this on it. It does not require the taxpayer to fill in that portion. Is that correct?
Yeah, but they're estimating, DOR is estimating a one-time startup cost of $10,000, which apparently they don't have enough money to absorb in their current budget. Is that right?
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. I'm sorry, I don't have a copy of the fiscal in front of me, but I do believe what we submitted was a minimal fiscal that would be absorbable by the department. So if
okay, let's do this then. Let's hold it up, and let's see if you can have some conversations with LFO. That would be great.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, I mean, it seems $10,000 ought to be absorbable. Yes, sir.
If I may, I think this is something we should look at closely because what we're effectively doing is advertising and marketing to put more kids on the Healthy Kids program. So that's going to be a fiscal. We're looking at cutting Medicaid by another 20%, and we're being irresponsible to the doctors and reimbursement rates and basically going to have more people not being able to be seen by doctors that end up in emergency rooms.
That may, in fact, be true, except they don't have insurance now, they're going to end up in the same place. But the point is, that's not a general fund issue, it's another fund issue. And they are funded to go to the full limit. But it's an issue. It will give health insurance to more kids, which I know you favor, although you may not favor the mechanism for gathering the money. So, but do you think you can work with that?
Chair Greenlake, the question is whether we can absorb the cost of... Yes, sir, we can.
Okay, well, we'll close the hearing if you work with them. Sandy, if you'd be involved in that, so we can see if we can get a new fiscal, and then we can get out of both of them.
Someone apparently thinks you're broke. So.
The Department of Revenue has got to be the richest. They have all the money.
Right. And they know where to get it, too, you know.
What's the bill number here?
2099.
Close the work session on 2099. Unless there's other business before the group, we are adjourned. Very efficient today.
That's not